Hey, so to tie up the main ideas from the last session and also to close off our discussion of the larger frameworks of the crime genre, I really want to get across a most important point about the whole notion of the crime film, and it is something that drags down a lot of films. You know, we as audiences have a need to feel empowered along with the hero. We like to see the victim become the destroyer because this helps us avoid our anxieties about being passive as opposed to being productive. So the point is that by associating with an active force against those things that seek to destroy us in any kind of crime film, we get to evade our fears about the wounded body and our fears about death. Now, unless of course we're talking about the horror genre where the thrills come precisely when we confront the wounded body. Another point about the victim to avenger journey is that it really should lead us toward a scene of exaltation, absolute triumph. So the signs of ever having been a victim are virtually erased. And the ultimate reason why I drew attention to Arlington Road is because it does both of these things. Arlington Road shows us a character seeking empowerment because he believes that his neighbors want to kill people. But everything that the hero Michael Faraday does to seek and defeat the bad guys, who are seemingly gentle and loving neighbors, it only leads him to become the destroyer. And as I suggested, there's a kind of touchstone with the Oedipal narrative there. But the important point is that the entire conspiracy plot works because Michael Faraday conceives of himself as a victim. So Arlington Road follows a very similar basic logic to Death Wish that we see time and time again. The victim becomes the destroyer. It's just that Arlington Road reverses the dynamic by having the victim become the destroyer in an unintentional way. So whereas in Death Wish, the hero takes it upon himself to willfully destroy the enemy, in Arlington Road, he's unwittingly becoming a destroyer and not destroying the enemy at all. In fact, he makes it seem as though he himself was the enemy all along. And a good interesting film to compare that with, to give another example, and a very, very good one, is one called The Parallax View from the 70s, and that is a Alan J. Pakula film that you really, really need to check out if you haven't seen it. So let's press on and get into the meat of the action genre. What is an action film? Well, first and foremost, let's define it in a way that we haven't really talked about yet, and say that without a doubt, the action film is the most profitable global film genre there is. And I point this out not because we're all money-hungry artists, but because the sales figures make one thing painfully obvious, and that's this. People take a lot of pleasure from this genre, and I think that we have an ethical duty to please. So why not learn the frameworks of the action genre to see what can be done in order to achieve that goal in ever more satisfying ways? Now, just as we can't possibly say that every film with a crime in it belongs to the crime genre, we also can't say that every film that has action in it belongs to the action genre. I mean, hey, look, there's some fog moving around over the ground. Must be an action film. No, it doesn't really work that way. Action films, by definition, are not just films that have some kind of action in them, but they are films that are primarily devoted to conflict, usually male conflict, and that conflict is part of forming the hero's identity through, you guessed it, action. So action films are about the ability of a man to establish his identity through physical activity. And this is related to the kind of empowerment Paul Kersey takes on in Death Wish. Although in that film, Kersey really just stands and shoots. There's not really any extended physical activity. The scenes of physical activity we see in that film are not really getting to the point of male omnipotence that the action film gives us as a heavy fantasy. You know, this overpowering male who is able to escape the normal boundaries and capabilities of the human body, and in a way that's very, very thrilling to us. And it's a form of escapism, really, that uses physical activity and violence to try and solve problems. And, you know, every genre is a problem-solving device. They just solve problems in different ways. And one of the ways in the action movie is through violence. But we need to really understand something about the violence in an action film in order to use it most effectively. And that is that the action is meant to thrill. Not to shock us, but to thrill. Shock in the movies is usually reserved for the horror genre or for the comedy genre. But in the action movie, we most commonly see violence that is intended to thrill rather than disgust us. So we're not really supposed to be disgusted by hand-to-hand combat or guns and shootouts or explosions or car chases. These are thrilling elements. They are scenes that show us the tests of the endurance of the body. They test the ability of the body to endure suffering, but in a thrilling way, not to shock us. And you know, all of this appeals to audiences who come with certain expectations for how this kind of violence in the action setting is going to satisfy them. But the number one expectation of all is to have their expectations exceeded. So the action genre almost always plays on the assumption that we will always get more. The next film will exceed the previous film in terms of making crazy things happen, impossible things, impossible tests of endurance, and impossible tests of what vehicles can do, and so on and so on. So the action genre has really trained us to want more in terms of that central thrill of endurance and excessive abilities to overcome problems with male power, essentially, was what it comes down to. And another really interesting thing to consider here is that we've been trained to see violence as a thing of beauty. We don't see the violence itself. And one of the reasons why this is so, and it's a very important part of the framework of the action genre, is the use of humor. The violence in the action film is often quite funny, and if it isn't funny, it's cartoonish. So when the hero... basically, a lot of the times, what happens is that this violence is connected with some kind of joke or one-liner. And this was very, very popular in the 80s and 90s, but we still see it to this day. And so when a hero breaks someone's neck, or after a dangerous chase scene, or even during the chase scene, there'll be a joke. And what do these things do? What do one-liners do? Well, they help relieve the tension. And they relieve the tension created by the thrill of violence. So even though we're not shocked or anything, we still need a reprieve from the absolute tension that all of that excitement puts us in. So in Die Hard, which is a very interesting film, you have Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. And this is not only very funny, but it's an obvious reference to the Western. And also a reference to the West, the particular kind of Western in which you have a reluctant hero. And reluctant hero is often something that's used in the action genre, so that's worth paying attention to as well, although not always. You can have hometown hero returns or a comeback kid kind of story, but I think reluctant hero is one of the ways that humor ends up playing the best. Something to be experimented with in any case. Anyway, some people consider that actually Die Hard had the first one-liner in all of the action genre. This seems like a bit of a stretch to me, but so I have been told by certain people. I think that Schwarzenegger had one-liners long before Die Hard came around. I mean, one of my favorites is when he... I forget which movie it was, but he killed someone and he says, "No sequel for you." And then another one he had was in Commando, and Arnold's there, he's holding his victim over a cliff, and the guy says, "You said you wouldn't kill me." And then Arnold says, "You know how I said I'll kill you last? I lied." And then he drops him off the cliff, and that's, you know, it's really violent beyond imagination, but Again, the humor softens it for us. It makes it a bit more palatable. It also helps it get through the Motion Picture Association of America, the censorship board. For some reason, they link the use of humor and violence as something that makes it more acceptable. So that's something to keep in mind as well. I think that the one-liner reaches its lowest point when it's used against, when it's used in non-human context. So I think of something like Snakes on a Plane, where they're making one-liner jokes about animals that are a threat. There it gets campy, because the tension's not the same when you're dealing with a human threat or being threatening towards a human than it is with animals. So you don't get that same kind of breathing room for the audience to chill out from the thrills and spills of the action. This is just my opinion, so something to consider. These jokes, regardless of whether they're for humans or animal context, like much of humor, what they do essentially is they bind the audience together and create a sense of community and safety. And the jokes are designed in such a way that everyone understands them. No one is excluded from them, no matter how stupid these jokes are. So that none of us ever has to say, yeah, we didn't understand why that's supposed to be funny. They're purposely constructed so that we're all in on the joke. So keep that in mind to avoid sort of insider jokes. You want it to be universally funny. Another thing about humor that I think is worth pointing out is that humor can help us in the audience compensate for the lack of power that we feel in terrifying situations. So humor is part of this important framework element that we looked at with respect to the crime genre, which is empowerment. Humor in some way empowers the audience. Now, related to humor, but somewhat different, is irony. Later on, we're going to discuss Terminator 2, which is an action, science fiction, nuclear war road movie, and what's so interesting there is that this film has so many scenes of ironic violence, where humor is used, but a particular kind of humor. So, for instance, if you've seen T2, you'll no doubt remember that one of the turning points is when John Connor tells Schwarzenegger that it is wrong to kill people. And the film shows us this real awareness of the consequences of violence, but it gives it great irony. Because what does Schwarzenegger do, or the Terminator do? He doesn't kill police. He starts shooting them in the knees. And, you know, he disables the aggressors rather than killing them. And this is totally loaded with irony. And it's a really brilliant move, too, in the story writing, because it then gives a lot of aesthetic value. It gives the film a whole lot of ballet, really. So when Terminator is shooting up from the window and expertly blowing out the knees of police officers, it's like really beautiful to watch. And so there's nothing particularly funny about it, but it's the irony that makes it really sing and really fly. So humor and violence can be quite effective, and irony and violence can be quite effective in terms of really bringing the audience in and making it not about violence, but making it sort of a conceptual point or a aesthetic point. I'm not sure exactly how to say it, but humor and irony can really make violence much more interesting than just violence for its own sake. There are some other ways, actually, that action movies make violence beautiful. They're very specific and subtle ways. One is very obvious. We get to see the body in action. And we all like to see the body at its prime, to see examples of very good physique, and we like to see sweat, and we like to see the body being tested. So the sweat and the muscles and the dirt and the grime. Another thing about the beauty of the violence and the action aesthetic is nice cars and other awesome vehicles, helicopters, airplanes, ships, even buildings, you name it. If you can get it in there, this can be an amazing part of bringing aesthetic elements into the story. Because we get to see the beauty of design, and we get to see the beauty of destruction and the aesthetics of destruction. And ultimately, what we're seeing is that the action movie is testing not only the hero's body in a natural state, but the ability of that body to use machines and tanks and airplanes, or to climb buildings or climb mountains or etc. Now, I mentioned earlier that one of the primary framework issues going on in the action genre is how that the action helps the hero form their identity. And I want to give an example from Die Hard. This is maybe perhaps a little more conceptual, a little more political, but I think it's a good example of giving the hero identity. Now, one of the first things to notice is something that Vladimir Propp, the Russian fairy tale specialist, came up with, was the idea of abstention. At least that's the word that he gave it, abstention. And the idea here is that the hero leaves the family and is separated from the family. And this is precisely the case in Die Hard. The hero is coming for Christmas in order to see the family, and he goes to see the wife. And his identity is sort of in flux because his wife has become a professional. Part of their separation has to do with her rise into the corporate world. And so John McClane comes to the office where she's working. And, I mean, these are all little subtle details, but I think they're what they're part of this giant framework that makes the story that we see possible, the impact of the story possible, because of their subtle nature. So what I would suggest you notice when you watch that film, keeping in mind all these issues of genre, of the action genre that we've been talking about, notice how his wife has actually gotten to such a position that she is given a Rolex by her boss. Now, normally a Rolex is something that's given to a man for creating great success for themselves or for their company. And here it's being given to John McClane's wife. This is very, very key because at the most subtle, subcontextual level, this is attacking or reducing him somehow. Well, it's not just reducing him somehow, it's taking his male power. I mean, the action genre is about male omnipotence, and here some part of that omnipotence is being given to his wife. So, at a symbolic level, a lot of what's going on in that movie is actually him running and jumping and kicking and fighting in order to gain his identity back. And the proof is really in the pudding. It all comes down to this watch, because those of you who remember the film, and if you don't remember, just run out right away and rent it and watch it, and thinking about these genre issues, how he defeats the bad guy is that his wife falls over the edge of the building and the bad guy is hanging onto her arm. And so Bruce Willis, or John McClane, unclasps the Rolex watch that was given to her and sends the bad guy falling down to his death from the roof of the building with the Rolex. So he's essentially regained his lost identity by taking away the masculine elements that she, at the unconscious or subconscious or symbolic level, stole. So that's one very, very strong example about how the action movie is really about forming or reforming the identity of the male or the protagonist. So keep those things in mind about the frameworks of the action genre. And in the next talk, I want to start laying out the frameworks of the disaster genre. And this is a genre that tends to share a great deal with the action film, so we are now well suited to move into that territory.